Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also to our listeners on Radio Verulam in St Albans. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Anthea Page. Our guests this week are Mike and Sean from Bristol UK Uncut, an organisation that looks behind the government's proposed cutbacks.
We also have Mike Soldner from Save Generate, an expert in alternative energy. We have a feature about a Mayan archaeological site in Guatemala, and the final letters of Robert Louis Stevenson are read once again by Alec Milne. Jeff Sparks is not in the studio, but he sent in the What's On guide, and we also have poetry from our resident poet. Time to welcome our first guests, Mike and Sean. Hello.
Hello.
I'm not going to say your surnames in order to protect your identities.
Thank you.
That's great.
But tell us a little bit about UK Uncut.
Well, perhaps just to say that back in October last year, a small group of people met together in a pub in North London and realised that what David Cameron had been saying about that we're all in this together wasn't true, that the large corporations were getting away with avoiding tax at the same time as the government was making massive public spending cuts. And so in Bristol, we've started Bristol UK Uncut.
Right. How many uncuts are there then?
Well, there's quite a few. There's this first one in the UK. There's one in the US. There's Canada, France, Portugal, Sudan. I heard there might be an Iran one, but I don't think that's probably going to last.
So who is like organising all of these? Is there a sort of...
It's been a spontaneous response to the way the banks have been operating, the way governments have been spending, cutting public spending. And in the UK, we've had, there must be at least 30 or 40 cities and towns around the country that have been setting up their own UK Uncut franchises, you could possibly.
So is this spontaneity through the usual sort of spontaneous nature of the internet that we're all told about?
Yeah, it's a very decentralised thing where the idea will come from, say... One group will have like they'll be starting an action where they'll be going after another tax avoider because they've uncovered some new evidence about them. Right. And so other people pick up on that and start another action targeting the same tax avoiders in their town. And so they are going about raising awareness and so it just spreads like that.
How many people in Bristol are you regularly in contact with?
Well, we've had probably four actions, any numbers between 20 and 30. We were in Broadmead before Christmas, protesting outside Vodafone, Topshop, Boots. And since Christmas, we've had a protest outside Barclays Bank.
So what sort of reaction when, you know, you're all stood there in the freezing cold and the snow, presumably? I mean, what sort of reaction are you getting from members of the public? Are they all sort of, and right behind you?
I think the problem you got at first is explaining the nature of the protest, which is actually quite complicated compared to, say, just a stop the war protest. It involves quite a few different things. So you've got to tie together the fact that there are spending cuts and that there's this tax avoidance, which could easily pay for those spending cuts. So once you explain this and explain this to people, then they're really quite receptive to it because they either are or know people who are going to be affected by it. So it's been overwhelmingly positive, I must say.
Okay, so what sort of cuts are going on in other countries then? I mean, obviously, you know, this global action is a response to a lot of similar actions. I mean, what are you hearing from your global counterparts?
Well, I can't speak for the details of cuts across the globe, but for example, we know in the United States that practically a number of states across the United States are protesting against the cuts that are being made there and are setting up their own uncut branches. But in this country, we're saying that we don't need to have public spending cuts, that the amount of money that could be raised in alternative ways, including dealing with the tax gap, could pay for what we're actually currently spending at the moment.
You can see in Wisconsin, in America in particular, there's been a very, very large sudden uprising about the fact that this is a senator called Scott Walker, who is basically trying to destroy the union's collective bargaining rights, which essentially means it's going to stop them being a union, having any legal power. And the response to that was overwhelming. I mean, it's not necessarily an uncut protest, it's not affiliated, but it's very much of the same ilk. I think it's powered by the internet and by this sudden realisation that we're being walked over by our elected representatives and they're not listening to us across the globe. I mean, it's known as austerity measures to try and...
do you find that there is a reaction from some people who say, well, cuts are necessary, and whilst they're unfortunate, your reaction to them is basically a selfish one of not wanting to have to deal with what is really necessary.
Well, let's just take one good example. Let's take the example of Sir Philip Green, who runs Arcadia, who got away with roughly 300 million tax avoidance. Now, if you think that in Bristol, the council, because of public spending measures, austerity measures, as Sean has just said, has had to cut £30 million from those public spending in Bristol. So one man's tax avoidance could have paid for 10 times the amount of public spending that Bristol has had to cut. I mean, I suppose that's the argument that we're making, that you don't need to make public spending cuts when you've got other money that's around.
Should we not be campaigning instead, really, for a stronger parliament if people with money actually realistically have more power than parliament?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, essentially, there does need to be a change in the law, but that's not going to happen without a huge change in the way people actually look at the law. And the law's got to reflect morality. It can't be the other way around. And at the moment, the law allows people to funnel money out of this country pretty much at will if they've got the means to do so. They've got an army of accountants, which large corporations have. So really, this also ties into the fact that you can, although, you know, a lot of people are saying, why are you targeting these shops or these banks? Why are you going in there and causing, you know, you're disrupting them? It's like, the point is that these companies do have more power than you and me. They have pretty much more power than the government as well. In fact, they're paying the government. So this makes them legitimate targets. You can go in there, you know, you can go and shut down a store that's owned by a company that's avoiding billions in pounds of tax. I don't really have a problem with that, because for them, it's a very small financial loss, but it publicly humiliates them and it also raises awareness.
How can you get people motivated to do something and engage in more protest when, you know, for example, 2 million people gathered in London for the anti-war march and it still happened anyway?
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, how do you...
I marched against the war, and I think many hundreds of thousands of people were pretty angry that the government did nothing about it. And you can understand the anger of people who marched on the 26th of March if the government doesn't listen to them. Mm. I suppose that what we're saying is that you have to choose your targets, you have to expose the broken promises that this government has made, and that we're saying at the moment, let's focus on tax avoidance.
I mean, politically, in terms of how the parties make up Parliament, do you think if we do switch to the alternative vote system, that might sort of generate a little bit more enthusiasm for Parliament, you know, possibly get more minority parties in, maybe?
It's very hard to say. It's quite a thorny issue, because both the yes and the no campaigns are basically making up stuff to suit their agendas.
Right.
It's the whole idea of it is, yeah, you can choose your candidates in order of preference. Yes, there might be one or two occasional extremist parties getting in, but you've got to look at the fact that the BNP themselves have joined the no campaign. It's not really going to help them. They know it. In fact, it's really only going to help.
I mean, if we have like a sort of a Martin Bell candidate, you know, say UK Uncut wants to stand up a person in a minority seat. I mean, do you see there's any more or less likely to get in?
There was a wonderful press release announced on Twitter on April the 1st that UK Uncut were going to become a political party. People started to kind of think, gosh, that there's a bit of hope then, but it was unfortunately, it was an April Fool.
Would there be any point?
No, of course not. we're not, I mean, certainly, I speak of myself, I'm not interested in setting up a new political party. Mm. What I'm interested in is exposing the corporate greed and the hypocrisy of a government that's making cuts when they don't need to.
I think the other point is that as soon as you go down the parliamentary route, you essentially have to play it on their rules, and they're all in league with it as much as the corporations.
So neither do you see that there is anyone in Parliament who offers us hope for Parliament to regain its strength,
well,
and nor do you really
think
I think
what I would say,
we
were looking at the, I don't know whether you've seen the recent Treasury Select Committee interviews of Barclays, chief exec. I mean, it was very clear that they were giving Barclays a really hard time because they had over 300 subsidiaries based in tax havens. So, yes, clearly there is some pressure, and MPs have supported UK Uncut.
And more public pressure from you.
Absolutely. We want people to join us in Bristol.
Yeah.
Come and join us on an action.
Send in their reports of the cuts as they find them affecting them.
How do people get in touch with you?
Well, there's email, which is bristoluncut@gmail.com. There's Twitter, and we're at bristoluncut, so you can find us on there. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/bristoluncut. So there's a variety of ways you can do it. We're not giving out phone numbers just yet. So.
Okay. Any political persuasion can feel free if they're unhappy about the cuts.
Absolutely.
Completely non-partisan. Yeah. I mean, this is an issue that affects absolutely everyone.
And what have you got planned coming up next in terms of protests?
Ah, well, should we announce that over the radio?
Oh, I don't know. Well, yeah, no, if you're interested.
Come
and find them online. Well, Mike and Sean, thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you, families.
Now over to our next guest, Mike Solner from Save and Generate. Hello.
Hi.
So what sort of organisation is Save and Generate? Obvious sounding question.
Well, Save and Generate is really a small independent consultancy. That's how we call ourselves. So it's basically come together, three friends from university, we kind of got together a year back to kind of address the issue of sustainable energy generation and sustainable energy use in the home environment, expanding also to small businesses. So that's what Save and Generate is out there to address, is this issue of independent information provision, make it very clear to somebody what they can do to save energy at home and to generate energy.
Individuals, families and small businesses, that's your...
That's right, yeah, that's the sort of range.
Okay, so how long have you been going?
About a year and a half now.
Right. Well, what sort of basic things are households already doing? What sort of things on top of that might you be? I mean, we're talking sort of various types of energy generation within the home sort of things. Is that what we're talking about?
That's right. I think there's been different levels where the government has tried to address it. In this country, it's all about improving the existing housing stock because that's where 70% of the improvements are going to have to be made. So it's all about addressing initially, I think the government has provided loans to support people looking at insulating their home, keep more warmth in the house before they look to do anything else. What they've introduced last April is a payment mechanism that allows people to actually introduce electricity generation to their home and as a result get paid a tariff for the electricity that they do generate. So it makes it much more cost effective for people to go down the route of generating electricity at home.
So if people have got some idea already and might be already doing things like, oh, maybe I should insulate the loft or something, you're there to be able to say, well, actually, it's not too difficult to actually, you know, get your own generation of electricity actually going.
Exactly. I think insulation is something that is affecting everybody because people notice when they've got a cold home, and it does affect people in like winters like we've just had. People do feel cold and feel the need to keep their house warm, and gas prices going up. So it's affecting everybody with fuel poverty obviously spreading across the country. People are realising...
What sort of methods of energy generation are there? I mean, I know there's obviously, you know, you assume wind, water, solar panels. I mean, is that basically what we're talking about?
Those are sort of the obvious ones. The solar panels, everybody knows about those. The wind turbines, everyone knows about those for negative or positive reasons. But the sort of technologies that are coming out that not so many people know about are the heat pumps, for example, where you're generating heat in the home from pumping essentially a heat fluid through the ground or extracting heat from the air to bring essentially heat into your house through a pump and heat exchanger system.
Right, okay.
So ground source heat pump, air source heat pump.
So what sort of initial costs are there if a family, you know, if dad is sitting there thinking, well, this sounds interesting, might save me a few quid, but I mean, presumably you have to invest in this in the first place.
Yeah, you're looking at the upfront investment costs, and those are this is what the government set out to address by introducing these feed-in tariffs to effectively make it more cost-effective in the long run. So you still have the upfront investment. There's no more grant supports available for electricity-generating equipment, but you do get paid every year or every quarter, you get paid a tariff. Okay. So that makes it...
So if I'm a guy who owns a two-up, two-down house, I mean, what sort of, you know, what if I live in a terrace or something, what would you say would be the most efficient methods of energy generation that might be most suitable for my home?
So if you're living in a house that is detached or semi-detached, you obviously got availability of garden space, potentially put an air source heat pump there or a ground source heat pump if you've got a large enough ground area. Solar panels, anybody who owns a house will have a roof, so if it's facing the right direction with the right... angle, it's pretty much going to be suitable.
A wind turbine in a suburban environment is maybe not really going to get down that well, I should.
Well, it's an interesting one because studies have shown that urban wind turbines are basically not cost effective and not generating the amount that you need. But in rural environments, we're consulting a lot of farmers that do look at wind turbines and small wind turbines. We're not looking at the big wind farms that nobody likes, but small wind turbines that provide enough electricity for your home or for your farm. So that's a very feasible, and it's in this country, in the UK, we've got the best wind resource in Europe.
Okay, so say I decide on some solar panels for my roof, what sort of investment am I going to have to make?
You're looking at average size investment in the UK would be a 3 kilowatt system, which will cost you in the order of £9,000 to £11,000 at the moment. it is a substantial investment, but people need to look at it as an investment. If you've got that sort of money tied up in a bank, which gives you 2-3% on your money, you know, here you can get a sort of 10-12% return on your investment. So it's a much far better investment to put that onto your roof, essentially.
Okay. How difficult is it to actually sort of maintain a solar panel? I mean, they're pretty high tech. I mean, you can't go out there with a screwdriver. And
once they're installed, maintenance is often said to be zero because they're self-cleaning. They've got very little maintenance over the lifetime, which is about 25 years. You may need to replace the inverter box after a certain amount of time.
Right. But what sort of comments could you make on the ability of the UK generally to generate electricity sort of en masse through green methods? I mean, because of the cuts and the recession, and obviously investment in this sort of stuff has just sort of whittled down, and a lot of it is in theory. It looks like we're going nuclear. What sort of comments would you make?
I think on the larger scale, there's a lot of innovative ideas coming forward, community engagement, communities coming together to generate, you know, electricity through one wind turbine to provide electricity for all of the community. There's schemes in place where people put an investment essentially to a community building that will take a large array of solar panels, providing electricity back to people in the local area. So it's kind of community investment schemes. Everyone's obviously realizing that the alternatives like nuclear and fossil fuels are, you know, have got their own issues. So,
on particularly given what's happened in Japan at the moment.
Absolutely. I think that's brought the nuclear back into the debate now, and the government's obviously...
Do you think, you know, regarding sort of the local nuclear establishments that they're trying to foster at the moment and what's going on in Japan, Bristol's a really ripe place to get people really interested in green energy because, of course, they'll all be terrified of nuclear.
Absolutely. But then you've got the en masse movements against tidal, against wind. You know, the Severn Barrage has been in the news for the government's just cut, basically, its support of the Severn Barrage. So there's the alternatives are being just as much attacked. So I think the realization what we're trying to promote is people have to realize the energy is going to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the alternatives and what do we really want? Where do we want to get our electricity
Do you think it's possible, like with organizations like yours and others, that it might not happen on such an en masse scale and that it will basically generally be a huge range of smaller, more local ways of generating electricity? You know, we might not actually have to all rely on like one big power station. We can all just have our own local schemes.
I think this is what we stand for, is distributed energy generation. While we realise that it might not be the most efficient way of generating energy, I think locally it gives you more ownership, it raises awareness. You know where a lot of people don't realise where electricity comes from anymore. If you're generating on your house, you realise this is what I'm generating and this is what I'm using. It raises that awareness, so it's got its benefits, and bringing that back to your home rather than having
so instead of sort of passively sucking in all the electricity without any heed to the cost elsewhere, it's bringing it at home to you.
Exactly. So I think this distributed energy generation away from the national grid concept is the way forward, because this is the way we're going to muster this sort of
what sort of money do you and your friends make out of this then?
We essentially provide the website, which provides free advice and free information for anybody to use. If people want to supply local installers or products, they can come through our website, get quotations from the local installers, and we get a small commission from the installers that get jobs through the site. So that's how we're financing the site. We also provide independent consultancy services to people who've got projects they want to work with us. So we work on a consultancy basis on that.
So you've got a fantastic interactive website. That means presumably sort of people can give you feedback on how they're actually getting on with this. Do you take that on board through your website?
Absolutely. The website is designed to bring back people's feedback. It's all designed around people actually providing back their experiences to others. So we have a platform where people can go on and give their feedback of installations that they have put in place, so that others can benefit from those experiences.
Right.
And it's all supposed to be generating a community of people feeding back into this website.
Okay. Yeah. How difficult did you actually find it to put together this website? How long has it taken?
It's taken a good year to get established. We've got a bit of a genius of a web designer who sits over in Melbourne who works with us via Skype. So it's a one-man band who's built the website. And we're pretty proud of it, I think, for what we've done as a small team of three.
Yeah. Okay, well, tell people where they can go and find this website. What is it called?
www.saveandgenerate.com. Saveandgenerate.com. Find it all there. Our contact details are there. We're very happy to provide further advice if people want to give us a call. Otherwise, email us on info@saveandgenerate.com.
Okay, and any final little tips? I remember being told that on Blue Peter, if you stick a brick in your toilet tank, that saves water and so forth. Are there any little tips that you could just sort of give away to people to make them think and look around their homes and think, all right, I can start conserving energy right now?
Yeah, I think excluding your drafts, you know, if you've got any drafty window cracks, put a sausage dog in front of your door, for example. Make sure you don't leave your heating on, leave your lights on at night. You know, there's various ways, you know, behaviourally you can really tackle your energy consumption straight away.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you very much. Good luck with your website. What's the name of it again?
Saveandgenerate.com.
Saveandgenerate.com. Mike Solner, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Our feature, courtesy of Anthea this week, is from Central America. Dialect's Anthea Page travelled to Tikal, one of the most impressive Mayan archaeological sites in Central America. It lies in eastern Guatemala, near the border with Belize. So let's chat a bit about Tikal. It's set out on a low hill, which arises above surrounding low-lying swampy ground, which is probably why the Maya settled here in around 700 BC. Another reason may have been the abundance of flint, used by the ancients to make clubs, spear points, arrowheads and knives. The wealth of this valuable stone meant good tools could be made, and flint could be traded for other goods. Within 200 years, the Maya of Tikal had begun to build stone ceremonial structures, and by 200 BC, there was a complex of buildings on the site of the Acropolis del Norte. In the mid-6th century, an estimated 100,000 people occupied the site, and it sprawled over 30 square kilometres. In 562, it was conquered by Yayor de Kinich II from southwest Belize. Tikal's greatness declined from around 900 as part of the general mysterious decline of the lowland Mayan civilization. An expedition was launched to the site by the Guatemalan government in 1848, and a scientific expedition was led by the English archaeologist Alfred Maudslay in 1881. Others followed, and since 1956, archaeological research and restoration has been carried out by the University of Pennsylvania until 1969, and the Guatemalan Instituto de Antropología e Historia since 1991. A joint Guatemalan-Spanish project has worked on conserving and restoring temples 1 and 5. So now let's join our reporter Anthea in the national park in Tikal. If you listen carefully, you may be able to hear the sounds of the howler monkeys in the jungle.
Ricardo Ortiz. We are in Tikal National Park, Guatemala, Central America. And I'm one of the employees of Hotel Tikal Inn inside of the park. There's only three hotels in Tikal. Tikal Inn is one of three, which is, feels very privileged, you know, to have been here for at least 45 years up to date.
You were brought up in the park. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, well, my father was an engineer, and in those days, you know, Petén was developing, and he came to help to refurbish the airstrips of the different airstrips in Petén, and Tikal was one of them. And he met some people from the Holiday Inn chain, which is a hotel chain worldwide known, and he started building this hotel in which we are right now. Somewhere along the way, he was left with the construction of the hotel because the Holiday Inn did not get the permission they were requesting, which was a 100-year lease. And so he was left behind, and he kept on building a hotel on his own. And this is what we have up to today. It's a family-run business.
So tell us more about the ruins, because they are very special Mayan ruins.
Well, you see, the city of Tikal is very well known because of its style of temples that it has, which is known like Chicanel. They resemble to be arrowheads pointing up to the sky. This style of architecture, besides of the size of the city, which is the largest city so far known to modern man, when you see the city, what you're looking at is the tip of the iceberg. There's over 3,500 structures, and most of them are beneath the jungle. So what you get to see are just the large temples. You get to see like Temple 4, which is the largest, Temple 1, 3, 5, 2. Down on the far east side, we have Temple 6, which is known like the Temple of the Inscriptions. This is what mainly attracts people to visit Tikal. But if you walk through the forest and the different trail roads that there are, you'll see lots of palaces, small mounds. You can just wonder, you know. It makes you go back in time and try to understand what was going on in the city. Tikal was, besides being a trade center, it was a ceremonial center as well. So far known the largest, like I was saying, in the lowland Maya of the Petén. The early settlements that are known of are about the year 600 before Christ until the early 10th century, about the year 913 AD.
What's the highest building in the park? It's pretty high, isn't it?
Well, we have temple number 4, which is 64 meters high. It's 210 feet tall from the base of the platform to the top of the cone. This temple is very special because most of the visitors that come to Tikal leave every morning from the hotels in Tikal to see the sunrise. Sometimes you don't catch the sunrise, but just to be sitting on top of this temple, contemplating the other large structures in the far east with the mist surrounding, the sounds of the howler monkeys, the sounds of the parrots, it just makes a wonderful experience. If you don't get to see a sunrise, you really feel the mystery and the mysticism of the site at this time.
So the ruins are set in the jungle. Can you tell us about the sort of animals that visitors might see?
Well, the most common or the most seen are the spider monkeys, which are very gracious. They jump from vine to vine. They use all five extremities, and I say all five because the prehensile tail is just like another extremity to them. Then you have the howler monkeys that most of the time they're always lacing around on top of the canopy of the trees. But when they start hollering, you know, they're there, and they're very frequently seen as well. We have coatis, agoutis, parrots, toucans, motmots, social flycatchers. We have gray foxes, white-tailed deers, and a large variety of reptiles and insects. Occasionally, tourists get to see jaguars and pumas in the site as well.
So what about the crocodile?
We have a very interesting story of crocodiles here in Tikal. Yeah, you see, we have the Crocodilo Moraletti. You find them in both of the main reservoirs that were left behind by the University of Pennsylvania. In the early 80s, we had this crocodile known as Goliath that he used to visit. He used to parade. He used to procession from hotel to hotel. And a few years ago, we used to have a sign in the pool of the hotel that before you go into the pool, you have to be aware of the crocodile. And they used to think it was hilarious, but it was true. Sometimes we have this big log floating on the pool. It was a 14-foot-length crocodile inside of the pool, so nobody got in, gladly. We always spotted him, but...
He died?
Unfortunately, he got shot by the park people because, you know, there was this sign that said that you were not allowed to take water with a bucket out of the reservoir. There was water pumps that you could pump your water, man-powered, and people didn't have time, so they would dip in their bucket. Goliath thought that they were an easy prey, and he killed about 3 or 4 of the people that worked in the park. You know, it's not his fault. We knew better. The park thought that he was a menace, a threat to the visitors and to the locals, and that's why they shot him in the early 80s, unfortunately.
But there's other ones that have taken his place.
Yes, you know, crocodiles roam around. You know, they were not brought in. They come in different channels of water from the different washaways from different areas of Petén. We have about 6 of them now in the park. They're well taken care of. We have some in the reservoir just behind the hotel, and occasionally you're able to see them hunt, which is very interesting.
What else can you tell us that's interesting about the park?
Well, the sounds. You see, Tikal is full of sounds and full of life and night. For example, at the distance right now, we can hear the crested guan. That's him. Right into the palm tree, eating out of the palms. It's the third largest bird in Petén. We have the great curassow, the oscillated turkey, and then the crested guan. And they're just, you know, they're very confident to be all over the place. They don't feel threatened, at least in this central area where the hotels and where the epicenter of their ecological site is.
What about parrots?
Oh, we have bundles of parrots. We have from the Aztec, the brown-hooded Aztec parrot, the Blue Lord Millie, the Yellow Cheek Parrot, or we know almost as well as the Red Cap Parrot. Actually, bird watchers come to Tikal because there's over 700 species of birds. About 300 are migrants, 400 are resident birds. From hawks, we have the Harpy Eagle, the Ornated Hawk Eagle, we have the Orange-Breasted Falcon, we have the Forest Falcon, the kite falcon, even the king buzzard, which is very beautiful to see.
What about the future of the park?
Well, unfortunately, the recession has been doing lots of damage to the tourist industry in Guatemala, which is a very very noble industry. But we're having internal problems in the park right now, and part of their problems is the corruption by the administration of the park rangers, that they're not turning in the money from the entrance fees. So when this happens, unfortunately, what happens is the park doesn't get back in order to invest back to it. And we have lots of the visitors that don't want to come to stay overnight night in Tikal because they're charging all these ridiculous bribes going in for the sunset, for the sunrise. This, unfortunately, even though that we've tried to tell authorities about it, you know, they're not doing nothing about it. So, unfortunately, people are just coming in for one day. Part of the beauty of Tikal is to stay overnight. You know, there's a campground besides the three hotels. People used to just love to stay in the park, but nowadays they feel like it's highway robbery, and I kind of agree with them, unfortunately.
Why doesn't the government stop it?
I think that they're interested more in the next elections. Who's going to be winning next elections, even if they're starting their period of in their government? We think that probably the minister and the directors of the Institute of Anthropology and History and the Minister of Culture and Sports, I think that they get a little bit of whatever, a cut from whatever comes out of the action of Tikal. Tikal is actually like the mother city or the mother ecological site in Petén for the development of other ecological sites and small communities that live around the parks, because these communities have to be benefit by the tourist industry. And when there's no tourism, there's no benefit for the people which are locals, who are the people that work in the different hotels, drivers, tour guides, stores, you know. Unfortunately, they're not looking at this. There's a new site in development, which is called Mirador. There's very high expectations for it. Unfortunately, the park doesn't have electricity 24 hours a day, which would be a plus in communication. I know we're in an ecological park, but many people are used to having electricity 24 hours a day, and this is something very important. So the government of Guatemala doesn't seem to know how to promote tourism, not only in Tikal, but Guatemala itself, unfortunately.
Going back to the beginning, you've got this lovely hotel. What's your website?
Okay, our website is Tikal in 2012, because as you know, in the 21st of December of next year, it's the end of the Mayan calendar, and everybody has big expectations about this, so we just picked up a web page. Besides that, we have our other web page is tikalin.com, and there's our email addresses. And we're just here to make people feel how special Tikal is, and for them to feel special as well in their visit to Tikal.
That was Anthea Page in the ancient Mayan site of Tikal in eastern Guatemala. The music chosen for that feature is from the CD El Palunk, the sweet indigena folklorica performed by Marimba Herencia Maya Quiche. And the tune in question is called Danza de los Guacamayas. It's time once again for a weekly instalment of the Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest McHugh and read by Alec Milne, himself a Scotsman. The music, Duff, is performed by Concerto Caledonia. This is the last and final selection, including the death of Robert Louis Stevenson himself on the island of Upolu, one of the Samoan islands in the Pacific Ocean.
The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. The final part. The last 2 years at Vailima, January 1893 to December 1894. By the new year of 1893, the addition to Vailima had been completed. In his biography, Balfour gives a good description of how the house looked in the last 2 years of Stevenson's life. The house in Vailima was built of wood throughout, painted a dark green outside, with a red roof of corrugated iron, on which the heavy rain sounded like thunder as it fell and ran off, to be stored for household purposes in the large iron tanks. The building finally consisted of two blocks of equal size, placed, if I may use the military phrase in this connection, in echelon. After December 1892, the downstairs accommodation consisted of three rooms, a bath, a storeroom and a cellar below, with five bedrooms and a library upstairs. On the ground floor, a veranda 12 feet deep ran in front of the whole house and along one side of it. Originally, there had been a similar gallery above the front of the library, but it so darkened that room as to make it almost useless for working. Stevenson then had half of the open space boarded in and used it as his own bedroom and study, the remainder of the veranda being sheltered, when necessary, by Chinese blinds. The new room was thus a sort of martin's nest, plastered, as it were, upon the outside of the house. But except for being somewhat hot in the middle of the day, it served its purpose to perfection. A small bedstead, a couple of bookcases, a plain deal kitchen table and two chairs were all its furniture, and two or three favourite Piranesi etchings and some illustration of Stevenson's own work hung upon the walls. On one side was a locked rack containing half a dozen Colt rifles for the service of the family in case they should ever be required. One door opened into the library, the other onto the veranda. One window, having from its elevation the best view the house afforded, looked across the lawns and pastures, over the treetops, out to the sapphire sea. The other was faced by the abrupt slope to Veia. The library was lined with books, the covers of which had been varnished to protect them from the climate. The chief feature within was a large hall that occupied the whole of the ground floor of the newer portion of the house, a room some 50 feet long and perhaps 5 or 30 wide, lined and ceiled with varnished redwood from California. Here the marble bust of old Robert Stevenson winked with approval upon many a curiously combined company, while a couple of Burmese gilded idols guarded the two posts of the big staircase leading directly from the rooms to the upper floor. In one corner was built a large safe, which, being continually replenished from Ipia, rarely contained any large amount of money at a time, but was supposed by the natives to be the prison of the bottle imp, the source of all Stevenson's fortune. In this room hung J.S. Sargent's portrait of Stevenson and his wife, Sir William Reed's portrait of Thomas Stevenson, two reputed Hogarths, which the old gentleman had picked up, two or three of R.A.M. Stevenson's best works, a picture of horses by Mr. Arthur Lemon, and, greatly to the scandal of native visitors, a plaster group by Rodin. To Sidney Colvin. Bad pen, bad ink, bad light, bad blotting paper, 29th March 1893, SS Mariposa at sea. My dear Colvin, have had an amusing but tragic holiday, from which we are returning in disarray. Fanny quite sick, but I think slowly and steadily mending. Belle in a terrific state of dentistry troubles, which now seem calmed, and myself with a succession of gentle colds, out of which I, at last, have succeeded in cooking up a fine pleurisy. By stopping and stewing in perfectly airless stateroom, I seem to have got rid of the pleurisy. Poor Fanny had very little fun of her visit, having been most of the time on a diet of maltine and slops, and this while the rest of us were rioting in oysters and mushrooms. Belle's only devil in the hedge was the dentist. As for me, I was entertained at the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, likewise as a sort of artistic club, a very rowdy character. Made speeches at both, and may therefore be said to have been like St. Paul, all things to all men. I have an account of the latter racket which I meant to have enclosed with this. The pianist, who was a president, became so excited that he did not leave the club till 3 a.m, and was believed to be sick in bed next day. Saw a good deal of Wises and Threlfalls. Did you know Threlfall in Cambridge? A friend of Jew's. He had a splendid photograph taken, likewise a medallion by a French sculptor. Met Graham, who returned with us as far as Auckland. Have seen a good deal, too, of Sir George Grey. He has gone down the Gladstone Hill, but But what a wonderful old historic figure to be walking on your arm and recalling ancient events and instances. It makes a man small, and yet the extent to which he approved what I have done, or rather had tried to do, encouraged me. St. George is an expert, at least. He knows these races. He is not a small employer with an inkpot and a Whittaker. Take it for all in all, it was huge fun. Even Fanny had lively sport at the beginning, Belle and I all through. We got Fanny a dress on the sly, made fit to Belle, gaudy black velvet and duchesse lace. And, alas, she was only able to wear it once. But we'll hope to see more of it at Samoa. It really is lovely. Both dames are royally outfitted in silk stockings, etc. We return, as from a raid, with our spoils and our wounded. When Belle was at her worst, just before she let a passenger draw her tooth with a piece of silk, no forceps on board, of course, she confessed that the thought of her silk stockings sustained her. I am now very dandy. I announced 2 years ago that I should change. Slovenly youth, all right, not slovenly age. So really now I am pretty spruce. Always a white shirt, white necktie, fresh shave, silk socks. Oh, what a great sight. No more possible, RLS. Epilogue, The Death of Stevenson. From Bell Strong's journal. In the afternoon, I was writing my letters. I heard him and Austin on the veranda by his study, making a great noise over their French lesson, learning a little French dialogue to recite at Christmas. I was still writing when I heard my mother's voice calling for hot water. I was not much alarmed, though. I went downstairs to see what was the matter. Louis was lying back in the big green leather chair in the hall, breathing heavily, and seemed unconscious. Talolo was bringing hot water for his feet, and his mother and Mama were both chafing his hands, and I ran at once for Lloyd. He was coming over from his cottage, quite cheerfully swinging a wreath he had made for the Consul General. He rushed off at once, Sosimo after him for the fastest horses to go for the doctor, and when I went back, Louis was still the same. It seems he had been looking on watching his mother making a salad, and was dropping the oil for her with perfectly steady hand. He suddenly said, "What's this? What a pain!" and put both his hands to his head. "Do I look strange?" he asked. Then he reeled and fell backwards. His favourite boy, Sosimo, caught him and carried him into the big room. He was never conscious after. We saw that he was dying, though each said to the other, "He is surely better," or "His pulse is stronger." Talolo and I knelt before him, chafing his feet and putting them into hot water, and as the room darkened one by one, all the Samoans on the place crept in silently and sat on the floor in a wide semicircle around him. Some fanned him. Others waited on one knee for a message, and others ran down the road with lanterns to light the doctor. When the big lamps were lit, the first doctor arrived. He was the surgeon from HMS Wallaroo. Lloyd had met him at the Tivoli Hotel and jumped off his horse, and the doctor took it and rode back, as he said, as though the animal knew what it was for. And it was Louis's own Jack. The doctor looked at Louis's eyes, felt his pulse, one heavy and strong, one very faint, and we read no hope in his face. He said he had done right to keep his head cool and his feet hot, and ordered all the windows open, and the night air came in, scented with gardenias. Then, when we were still anxiously trying different remedies, I looked out and saw the twinkling of a lantern, and knew the Lloyd had come back. Dr. Funk, with his lame foot, could only get up here as far as Skeens, and had to walk the rest of the way. When he arrived, he ordered a little brass bedstead from the guest room, and it was placed in the middle of the great hall. Four boys carefully carried Louis and laid him upon it, and then the missionary Mr. Clark came. We all went to bed then, and Mr. Clark knelt beside Aunt Maggie and prayed. Lloyd supported Louis with his arm. He was still unconscious and only breathed fainter, and at longer intervals, until at last he died at 8:10. it was always his wish to be buried at the top of the mountain that bounds Vailima, the grave of a famous chief of ancient times. He even had a window cut in his study so that he could always see the place. I was determined that his wish should be carried out. You who pass this grave, put aside hatred, love kindness, be all services remembered in your heart, and all offences pardoned. And, as you go down again among the living, let this be your question. Can I make someone happier this day before I lie down to sleep? Thus the dead man speaks to you from the dust. You will hear no more from him. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hill.
Well, our profuse thanks to Alec Milne for reading the 14th part of the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, and of course all of the other 13. Next week, we start the first instalment of Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve. Now time for a couple of poems, courtesy of our regular poet, Tim Burrows.
Of this haven are covered with charts, paintings and photos like old weathered marks. But no anchors drag in the harbour outside, no tall ship masts fill up the sky. Only one silent mariner gazes out to the sea, waits for the tall ships to return to the quay. Bring cotton from Bombay, rubber from Ceylon, tobacco from Virginia, silk from Hong Kong. Only water taxis and booze cruises disturb the still air as the Great Britain slumbers in her dry dock there, as the Matthews motor purrs on through the brine to the chatter of tourists dressed up so fine. Only one silent mariner gazes out to the sea, waits for the tall ships to return to the quay. Bring cotton from Bombay, rubber from Ceylon, tobacco from Virginia, silk from Hong Kong. This old port has lost its soul, so they say. Cabot won't return, he drowned far away. No tales of daring resound round tavern walls, to the clinking of tankards and brawls in the hall. Only one silent mariner gazes out to the sea, waits for the tall ships to return to the quay. Bring cotton from Bombay, rubber from Ceylon, tobacco from Virginia, silk from Hong Kong.
Death's Valley. Ruled by the Bible and the gun, ruled by the Quran and the bomb, divided by walls and cultural chasms, driven by hate and inequality, dying the same in pale equality, dying the same in gory equality. Widows and fatherless children, flowers and photographs in cemeteries, trees line the avenues of death, wails of mourning drown out the birdsong at dawn. A low lament covers the songs of joy. A stone replaces the child's toy. No sun in the sky this day. Whirring helicopters of death fill the sky, bringing swift death by missile, a savage bolt from on high. Palestine, the angel of death hovers above you, spitting death, preaching separation, crying tears, delivering desolation. Your sons and daughters and those of Israel dwell in the valley of the skull, dying both oppressed by division, growing the bitter fruit of enmity, turning words of spirit into the poison of hatred. But a widow, her cheeks lined with dust and tears, her heart full of sorrow and fears, carries a small olive tree to the wall, a symbol of lost orchards buried beneath, yet also a prayer for hope, ripe fruit for future generations.
Well, there we go, set to some delightful music and sounds, the poetry of Tim Burrows. Time now for the What's On. Jeff Sparks can't be with us in the studio, but he sent us a script, and Nick Payne is here to read it for us. Hello.
Hello. This is your What's On guide from Dialect, starting with Tuesday, the 19th of April. Saxon will be performing with support from Wolfsbane at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol, as part of their Call to Arms World Tour. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £17.50 in advance. On Wednesday, the 20th of April, Son of a Nun will be performing with support from Mortal Dilemma, Sundance and So Am I as part of a local showcase right at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. So on to the song of the week, and I present Smoke Fairies. This duo performed in 2007 and they have supported musicians such as Brian Ferry, The Handsome Family and Richard Hawley. To date, they have released 3 singles, 2 EPs, and an album titled Through Low Light and Trees, from which this track, Strange Moon Rising, came from.
Thank you.
That was Smoke Fairies with Strange Moon Rising from the album Through Low Light and Trees. On Friday 22nd of April, it's the start of the 15 Hands Festival at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. This festival is on until the 25th of April and features acts such as Yes Rebels, John E. Vistick, Daisy Chapman, Last Rites, Joe Volk and many, many more. Doors open at 2 p.m. and a weekend ticket for 4 days is £10 in advance. Finally, on Saturday the 23rd of April, John Renbourn of Pentangle fame will be performing with Robin Williamson of Incredible String Band fame at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £14 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you to Nick and also to Jeff. That's all from Dialect this week. Please don't forget about the Bristol Folk Festival that's coming up at the Colston Hall at the end of April. You can always stick the Bristol Folk Festival into Google or your favourite search engine for more details. Thank you very much to Mike and Sean from UK Uncut and also to Mike Soldner from Save and Generate. Features were by Anthea Page and Alec Milne, read the letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Thank you to Tim Burrows for the poetry and also to Jeff Sparks for the Watson Guide, which was read ably by Nick Payne. And the studio engineer was Johnny Royden. The producer was Alec Milne, who also edited the show this week. I've been John Peters Common, and it's for me to say goodbye until next week. Goodbye.
At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead in a full-hearted even song
of joy illimited. Upon a coppice gate, the sky was specked to grey, winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled vine stems saw the sky like strings of broken lyres. All mankind that haunted nigh had sought the house. Sharp features seem to be a century's corpse at lent. He's gripped the cloudy canopy, the wind his death lament. The ancient pulse of German birth, the shrunken heart and dry in every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I.
A voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead in a full-hearted evensong.
Joy illimited, an aged thrush frail, gaunt and small, in blast beruffled plume, the chosen verse, the flinging song upon the growing. Sound was written on terrestrial things afar on earth.